Hi, everybody. This is Noreen Ehrlich, and you're listening to Defy and Hustle Radio. And I'm here with my co-host, Kelly Trepanier.
What up, everybody?
And we're dancing because we like that song, Happy. And that's a great song to put on when we were pulling it for the show today. We saw that it was on
very fitting
24 hours a day. So if you're in a bad place in your life or just want to be in a better place, you can put on the song Happy by Pharrell 24 hours a day. And we thought that song was appropriate because the topic we have for you tonight is something near and dear to my heart. It's about having a positive workplace. It's about positive leadership. And we have a special guest with us, and he'll come on in just a moment. But for those of you who know about our business, my business, Defy and Hustle Group, we talk about, we promote how to shift your own life, shift your own leadership of your life, and more importantly, how to go into an organization and shift your ability to thrive as an organization. Really, really make some leaps out of mediocrity into another realm where you are sought after as a business. And our guest tonight, who is Kim, Professor Kim Cameron, and he is the William Russell Kelly Professor of Management and Organizations. And there's a lot more in there, but he's at the University of Michigan. And he is the founder of a discipline called Positive Organizational Scholarship. And Kelly, why don't you tell people a little bit about that, and then we'll invite him in to talk about positive organizational leadership.
Well, and just coming back at Defy and Hustle, it is something we do talk about a lot, of that there has been a paradigm shift.
Yes.
And where we used to kind of be based off of Darwinism's theory of competition, we've really understand that it's actually an age of cooperation, and that nature is working together. And the most successful organisms and organizations have this as like a foundation. And
moving
a
out of
set.
Fear-based motivations into, you can call it trust-based, you can call it loving-based, but it's a higher energy, it's a higher frequency of how to look at life and look at possibilities that are not driving people because they're afraid of losing their security, basically.
Right. Yeah, we're moving out of this dog-eat-dog world. And when you have that energy in the workplace that it, you know, you don't really want to show up. Mondays are heavy days and it's stressful and it doesn't lead to a great work ethic, as opposed to when you're implementing a more positive kind of abundant attitude that Kim Cameron is going to discuss. And so in this positive organizational scholarship, it's a scientific study of what produces extraordinary performance right. in organizations and their employees.
Right. So let's welcome Professor Kim Cameron.
Well, thank you, Noreen. Thank you, Kelly. It's really a delight and honor to be on your show. I'm excited about this, and I admire what you do a lot. You reach a lot of folks, a lot more than I do.
We do. Well, thank you very much. Well, we are in Greenwich, Connecticut. Where are you speaking to us from right now?
I am in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay, beautiful.
You just got back from Washington.
That's right. I was in Washington, D.C. yesterday. There was a time in my life I lived up the street in New Haven, Connecticut.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
where I got my PhD.
Yes, you did. We saw that. Let's see. Your research is on organizational virtuousness. And you have been published in more than 140 scholarly articles and 15 academic books. You've written 15 academic books. So why don't you tell us what is meant by organizational virtuousness?
So those are words that are normally not acceptable in scholarly rigorous or even in business contexts where the bottom line matters, that is profitability, productivity, customer satisfaction, shareholder value, and so on, are the things for which leaders are held accountable. So when you walk in and start talking about virtuousness or talk about happy or talk about positive, those words just don't resonate. People say, well, wait a minute. It's fine if I have time. I'll take a seminar or I'll go feel good about myself. But for the most part, folks, I have responsibility to shareholders. I got to produce bottom line results. So don't bother me with all this business. So for the last 20 years, we've been essentially asking the question, if you focus on positive practices, if you demonstrate positive leadership, in fact, if your organization embeds or institutionalizes virtuous practices, what are those? Those are forgiveness and compassion and kindness and trustworthiness and integrity and so on. I mean, it's grandmother's advice. If your organization demonstrates or has as simply part of its culture those practices, what happens to profitability? What happens to productivity, innovation, quality, customer satisfaction, and so on, not to mention employee engagement and satisfaction? Turns out the research is overwhelmingly convincing that when you implement positive practices, profitability, productivity, quality, innovation, customer satisfaction, employee engagement all go up significantly from the norm and or from when compared to the times when you did not practice those kinds of activities. So we've attempted to identify organizations in the least likely places that these words or these practices would be acceptable. One of them, for example, is financial services, Wall Street firms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of all the places on the planet that don't care about virtuousness or positivity.
Yeah, Noreen was talking about that earlier, just the crazy practices that can
I came out of. I don't know if you know, Kim, but I come out of Wall Street. So I was in real estate private equity for a long time. And part of that, I was at Ernst & Young, and it was a cowboy atmosphere. I was more in the boutique funds, but it was wonderful and it was terrible. So
but
go
it's
ahead.
Not, yeah, it's not an ooey gooey share your emotions.
No,
kind of
or even when they tried, it didn't always work. But I want to hear what happened when you went there.
Well, the incentive systems are very clear. I mean, you know, show me the money,
mm-hmm.
and I got one goal. And that is, I got to show results. So we took 40 firms, measured their performance, and the extent to which they had implemented these positive practices at, we'll just call it time one, and then exposed them to a variety of practices, positive organizational scholarship. That's the general umbrella term that kind of captures all these various practices, positive leadership. We measured them at time two, that's a year later, and then again at time three, again 2 years later. And we then simply looked at financial performance. That is, they measured that in six, I mean, different firms measured it in different ways. So we took six different measures of financial performance, as well as customer retention, employee retention, innovation, and so on. Turns out we could account for 45% of financial performance or financial outcomes on the basis simply of whether or not they were improving or not in positive practices. Now, I don't know anything that is able to predict Wall Street performance by 45%. So it was such a strong number, we were skeptical that actually could be true. But we have then verified it in a variety of other kinds of organizations, and sure enough, positive practices predict financial performance.
So the bottom
line?
As
well as a variety of other things. Sorry.
Bottom line. Bottom line increased by 45%?
That's correct. Well,
really?
Financial performance didn't always mean bottom line. It meant in some cases, I should go back and look at the six different measures, but in some cases it was the firm value, in some cases it was stock price, in some cases it was you know, equity, in some cases it was just cash on hand and so on. I mean, people, the measures that each of these firms used, in some cases they were exactly the same, but in some they were different.
Right.
So we said, we won't superimpose on you your own success measure. We'll use whatever you use, whatever you decide is important, and we'll use that as our outcome. So anyway, that was just one study of a whole bunch that suggests that there's something to this when organizations take it seriously. The trouble is that it's, you know, been defined over time as soupy, syrupy, saccharine, sweet, you know, happyology, naive, irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And turns out it's not. Turns out it actually works in
organizations.
And it's
probably hard to measure because...
It is.
Right? When people go in, another thing that we do at Define Hustle is we work with people to break patterns, and patterns don't break immediately. So if you go in and you tell somebody be positive or do something, they very quickly fall back into their old way of doing things.
Sure.
And so is that something... Or how can somebody deal with that?
You have 45% increases. It's not easy to really change. We're up against a really deep-rooted
conditioning.
So what are they? I want to know what these positive practices are and how would you implement them in the workplace?
Well, those are really important questions. Let me there are two sides to that question. One is, what do we measure, actually? I mean, how do you figure out that an organization is actually improving? And then the second question is, well, what are some specific activities or practices or implementation options that organizations can implement? So let me address the first one initially. So there's an instrument. It's not comprehensive. It's not the only one. It's not maybe irrelevant in a lot of organizations, but it's an instrument we use, and we measure 8 different dimensions. Each of these dimensions are measured by several different items, and they essentially identify behaviors that are going on in the organization. So we're not measuring an individual. We're measuring the extent to which these behaviors are typical of the organization. And there are things like, for example, one dimension has to do with gratitude and appreciation, the extent to which people, when they do well, get recognized and gratitude is expressed and appreciation. Another one has to do with dignity and respect, a respectful environment. People are feeling not harassed, but rather flourishing. Another has to do with compassion and support when there are difficult times. I don't remember now the reference for this, but I have seen this kind of study several times that indicates that you think of any of your friends or any group of people, more than 50% will be dealing with some very difficult, painful experience. So compassion is almost always a relevant factor, always a relevant response, because there will be somebody who needs it. Another is meaningfulness and purpose. That is, some kind of profound purpose, something more than just my paycheck. Is there something that I care deeply about in this organization? And the extent to which the organization makes that clear and highlights it.
But I think that's more...
Oh, excuse me, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but it just in 2019, you're hearing more and more about people wanting to have purpose for their careers.
Exactly. And, you know, there are a lot of organizations where that's just not even on the plate. It's not what we do here, you know, is provide purpose or meaningfulness to individuals, especially other than just I got a paycheck. I need a paycheck. I got student loans. I got children to pay for. I got a mortgage on my house and so on. I mean, that's it. But the items in that dimension have to do with something more important than just my own reward. Is there something that's profound and meaningful about the activity in which I'm engaged? And so on. Anyway, there are forgiveness, understanding. That is the extent to which when pain occurs, when downsizing or when budgets get cut or when people's assignments get changed or when people are just offended by abrasions and so on, the extent to which the organization itself is a forgiving organization. That particularly is relevant in places like downsizing organizations and places where the pressure is really, really high. And then trust and integrity, you know, it's that's sort of a foundation. Without trusting individuals and without integrity in the organization, I mean, hardly anything else works. So those are examples of the dimensions we measure. So when you get better on those dimensions, financial performance goes up significantly, as does productivity and quality and innovation and so on. And it's not hard to understand that that would occur. You know, once you highlight it, people say, well, it makes sense to me mm-hmm. that that would occur. And sure enough, it does. Empirically, it's verified.
So I want to come back to empirically for a second, but
sure, but great.
Just before that, what it seems like when you mention, I've got a few of the dimensions that I wrote down: the gratitude, dignity, compassion, meaningfulness, trust, and integrity. These are human qualities that maybe didn't exist in the old paradigm of just make it happen. That's plutocratic drive, industrialization drive, that maybe was necessary at the time, but we're evolving past that. And I think even the millennials are not wanting to just work for money. That's not their primary driver anymore. So businesses are having to look at how they're organizing themselves and around what value they're organizing themselves.
Exactly. You know, we have a doctoral student, a past doctoral student at the University of Michigan who did a dissertation asking the question, is there a difference between, for example, millennials or Generation Z or whatever, and the greatest generation or the baby boomers or Generation X and so on? I mean, all the generations that we label. It turns out that the differences were very, very small, except on one or two dimensions. Technology has mattered a lot, and so the greatest generation or the baby boomers just didn't grow up with a screen in front of them, a keypad, so they don't have to type. You know, everybody knows how to type now. But in terms of meaningfulness and purpose, when you graduated from college, you also, I suspect, wanted to do something other than just make a paycheck. You also wanted to make a difference. However, organizations were much less attuned to that. So there were far more sort of organization man. That was one of the sociological books at the time that described this phenomenon. That is, people go to work and they're sort of a cog in a wheel. But when they had something that mattered, they, in fact, also were motivated by that. They also desired that. So as it turns out, we're putting a lot more emphasis on it now, thank goodness, but it's not a new phenomenon. That is, almost all human beings at their very core want to be valued and want to create value. That's why we have children, you know. That's why we create organizations and so on. Anyway, I thought it was just an interesting side trip.
It is. Mm-hmm. When I think about some of the literature that was out decades ago, like Death of a Salesman, it was often about an unhappy, typically a man, that was unhappy in his organization but was just trying to get by because he had to provide for his family.
Exactly.
So that was decades ago. You do, there's a lot of leadership books out there. And,
oh, goodness.
Yeah, so
190,000 actually is the number.
They often look at, we have a tendency in our culture to idolize people who are quote-unquote successful because they've made money. Mm-hmm. And what is the difference between your approach to leadership and your books, and two of which I want to bring up here? One is Positive Leadership Strategies for Extraordinary Performance. And another one, which complements that, is Practicing Positive Leadership and Tools and Techniques that Create Extraordinary Results. But talk about the reason that your leadership book is different from some of the others that idolize, you know, Walsh or somebody like that.
Sure. Well, it's a good question. The reason I know there's 190,000 plus books on leadership is that log on to Amazon.com and that's how many references you get. I don't know the percent for sure, Noreen and Kelly, but I'll bet 90% or more of those books are storytelling, inspirational events, mm-hmm. top 10 lists. Here's what I did when I was a leader. I'm sure it'll work for you. You know, here's the things that I've learned over my career that were especially inspiring, and so I'm going to share them. And, boy, there's nothing wrong with that. They're often uplifting and inspirational, insightful. But empirical evidence is rare. That is, the extent to which somebody has said, you know what, we've tested this. There's evidence that if you do X, you will get Y. That kind of data is very rare in leadership books. So I've sort of made it my own mission. It's not my own, but it's many people have done the same, but certainly not 190,000. I mean, I, again, less than 10% of those books have any evidence at all that when you do something, you get a result. So what I've tried to do, and the only reason I write a book, I mean, you don't need my books, for Pete's sake, on that list. Mm-hmm. But what I've tried to do is to say, you know what, there's evidence. You do this kind of activity, you engage in these kinds of implementation strategies, and sure enough, you get the results you want, assuming that the results you want are the things we measure, like profitability and productivity and so on, employee engagement.
There is something really to be said about that empirical, just the studies and the research, because although all these beautiful books on leadership, I think, correlate to what you were discussing on virtues, it's striving for our highest aspiration. Mm-hmm. You know, it's within those stories, and it is what we gravitate towards. But when you have this research, it takes it so much deeper. So many people actually believe in it, and actually, you know, they just start to say, oh, okay, this is legit. Now I can take this practice on, as opposed to my yoga teacher telling me to sit and meditate and focus on gratitude.
Especially if you go into the financial world, where they won't give you the time of day unless you give some sort of logical proof. And to some degree, I agree with that. You know, show me why this works instead of is just... Yeah. Just blowing extra smoke where I don't have time to deal with that. But Professor Cameron, wait just a second. We're going to go to break. When we come back, I wanted to have our audience members hear you talk about some of the four steps you have. I don't know if they're steps, but they're positive leadership practices, starting with creating a culture of abundance. So stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Defy and Hustle Radio.
Friends to you, don't waste your time. Here's why, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like...
Hi, everybody. This is Noreen Ehrlich, and you're listening to Defy and Hustle Radio. I'm here with my co-host, Kelly Trepanier.
Hello, everybody. We have a great guest with us today.
We do.
Kim Cameron. He's a professor at the University of Michigan. And we are here today discussing positive organizational scholarship, which Cameron is the founder of. And really, on a simple, we're discussing positive psychology and how what produces performance, these extraordinary performances in organizations, what helps companies succeed in
everything,
like avoid downsizing in times of crisis, and just how it can also just affect us on every level of our being.
Really jumpstart your growth if you have positive psychology, if you set some new goals and really focus on getting yourself as the leader and the people that work with you to go to perform at their highest levels and be committed to their work and be committed to your organization. You have no choice but to jumpstart the success of your organization. So we welcome back Professor Kim Cameron from the University of Michigan.
Thank you, Noreen. Thanks, Kelly, for having me on.
Yeah, we're stoked to have you on. This is such a great topic. And we just kind of left off, well, in one part, this is a subject that a lot of people brush over. And when you start to talk about positive psychology or aspects of virtuousness, which is compassion and forgiveness, it's not really taken too seriously, and you really took that to the test by going to different financial institutions and going to companies where this, it's just not a common practice or understanding, and you have over decades of research of actually getting empirical evidence that supports that positive psychology actually does make a difference, is incredibly important, and in one study even increased financial performance by 45%, which is huge. And you were able to actually test that, you know, and get these results. So let's dive back into what are these positive practices of and what creates this positive leadership and these positive strategies that organizations can begin to understand and learn about.
Thank you. And there are, it would be nice if there was a cookbook. I wish there was. And I think probably some people have tried to write one. Because every organization, of course, is different. Every every NBA team has its own formula for how you're going to win the NBA championship, you know. So there isn't a cookbook, but there are a set of practices that have in fact paid off and that make a big difference. And let me just highlight two or three of them, or three or four of them, and I won't go on too long. At least I'll try not to go on too long. So one of the things, for example, that we know a lot about, and almost everybody is familiar with the findings that positive interpersonal relationships matter a lot. Teamwork, collaboration, having people get along, all those kinds of things are going to help the performance of both individuals and organizations go up. What's not generally recognized, however, is what it is that lies at the heart of good interpersonal relationships. That is, why is it that some relationships are better than others? And as it turns out, let me just highlight a couple of studies that make a point, and I'll tell you what the point is in just a minute. So this study was done at our university, in which one of my psychological colleagues took individuals who, all of whom were entering the University of Michigan as freshmen. She simply asked them to identify their goals for the year. Now, everyone has lots of goals, but she categorized the goals into two types. One type was called achievement goals. That is, I want to get good grades, I want a girlfriend, I want to be popular, I want to make the team, and so on. Another kind of goal was called contribution goals. I want to make a difference, I want to contribute to something, I want to have something get better because of what I've done. Well, she categorized these goals into two types and put people in groups depending on which type of goal was dominant in their life, achievement goals or contribution goals. Then the study was she followed these students for 1 year, measuring things like how well they got along with their roommates, how many times they got elected to a club office, and social factors. Another was how many minor physiological symptoms they experienced, headaches, nausea, got the flu, missed class, and so on, physical factors. Another was academic or cognitive factors, what their grade point average was at the end of each semester, what their test scores were, and so on. On every single dimension, contribution goals were far more predictive of performance than were achievement goals. That is, it's what they contributed more than what they got. That's confirmed by another study of kidney dialysis patients. These people, the outcome of this study was how well people are recovering. They're hooked up to a kidney dialysis machine. They measured each of these people on two factors. One is, to what extent are you being loved, supported, and cared for by somebody? The other factor, to what extent are you loving, supportive, and caring, making a difference in somebody else's life, even though you're physically constrained? Turns out, there was a significant difference in the outcomes. Those people who were had high scores on contributing to, making a difference in, supporting, caring, loving for someone else were far more healthy. We had recovered more, or they were healthier than those people who had high scores in having somebody care for them. That's confirmed by another study of multiple sclerosis patients. This was a controlled experiment where half of these people were assigned to receive a phone call once a week for 2 years, having somebody express love, support, and concern to them. The other half were assigned to place a phone call to somebody else, expressing love, support, and concern. At the end of 2 years, they measured well-being, physical activity, self-efficacy, that's confidence and competence, hope, depression, eight-fold difference. Those people who placed the phone call were eight times healthier than those people who received the phone call. Now, I'm going to stop there. There are a bunch of those studies that highlight the notion that when you provide opportunities for people to contribute, they actually do better than simply meeting their needs all the time. So it's very common in organizations to say, well, you know, just give people stuff. Have them, provide opportunities for them to earn more money or, you know, get things. Turns out the contribution is a better predictor of performance. So things like, for example, providing opportunities for people to mentor or coach or assist somebody else. So, you know, Noreen, you're so spectacular. You're so terrific. What we need to have you do because you're so good is mentor Kelly. We need to have her as good as you are. That is, your reward is a chance to coach or teach. Another is, we a person here at our my university, my business school, knows about this, and so she's instituted a 1+1 reward system. So you do something, Kelly does something spectacular, I give her an award, but then I give her a second one, which she can give to somebody else. She'll give the second one to Noreen.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime anybody does spectacular work, they get a chance to give an award. They get one, but they also give an award. That sort of reminds me of Delta Airlines. I'm a 3-million-miler on Delta, and what they give me as a result of being a loyal flyer is they give me certificates, which I can hand to a Delta employee. And I don't know for sure what it is. It's free flights or points in their bank or something. But when I give one of those certificates to somebody who does something wonderful, I mean, it is a big deal to them. They always say, wow, this is so terrific. And, man, that makes my day. That's the thing that most is motivating for me, is I get a chance to give an award to a Delta employee because I'm a loyal flyer and so on. And there's a whole list of those. So sort of point number one is creating great relationships matters a lot, but one of the keys to great relationships is giving people a chance to make a difference in somebody else's life, help somebody else flourish.
And I love that you really clarified that it's not just providing an opportunity where they can make more money or providing an opportunity where something that's already they have, it's an ability to contribute that creates value for them, that they feel important, that they're actually having a purpose, that then circles back into those eight dimensions of behaviors that you were discussing earlier that leads to, you know, an increase of positivity.
Yeah, not rocket science,
no.
But not often practiced.
Exactly.
You know?
Sadly, yeah, it's amazing. I wanted to have you talk for a second about there's create a culture of abundance. These are, I'm reading from your mm-hmm. book about practicing positive leadership. And you have create a culture of abundance. You just spoke about develop positive energy networks. There's one here that is called establish Everest goals. And this is where I start with my clients. Where are you going and can you push it out even further? So why don't you talk about what you meant when you said establish Everest goals?
So it's a good question. And I suspect, I'm certain I'm not the only person that's coined the term Everest goals, but the reason I use it in writing about this stuff is that an Everest goal to me is something that represents the highest achievement that I can even consider. I mean, to finally get to Everest, that's the culmination. That's the peak. So the question is there an opportunity? I mean, is there a goal? Is there an aspiration that we can help individuals or, in particular, companies identify that would represent the best we can imagine? See, in the original Latin and Greek, the word virtuous simply refers to the best of the human condition. The highest aspirations we have for ourselves is a virtuous state. So in music, virtuosos are the most inspiring, best performers. You know, in art, virtuosity in art is the most uplifting, inspiring art. So if the world was virtuous, there would be no poverty, no war, no... Everybody be well educated, you know, we'd all get along. So it's the best we can imagine. So then the Everest goal is simply a tool saying, let's see if we can identify the best we can imagine. What is it we could reach for that would represent the culmination of what we consider meaningful and purposeful and worth expending our effort and energy on? And sometimes those are multiple goals. Sometimes it's only one. Sometimes it's long-term. Sometimes it's short-term. But what's happened when we help organizations in particular stretch beyond just shareholder value or stock price and think much more clearly about what would be an Everest goal, performance changes, individuals change. I'm going to give you one quick story.
Okay, good.
Prudential Financial. Most of us know that organization. Had an opportunity. Well, Prudential retirement business, the retirement business within Prudential Financial was struggling, and so they decided in order to really get the economies of scale and size they needed in the marketplace, they needed to merge. So they merged with Cigna Retirement. Now, that's like merging the Yankees and the Red Sox, you know, one in New England, one in New York. And assuming it would be pretty tough business. John Kim was the name of the CEO who had been CEO at Cigna, became the CEO at of the merged organization, Prudential Retirement. And John was very interesting, and the story, we've written this up, the story is a really amazing, inspirational success story, what he did with that organization. I mean, they were spectacular. But with regard to Everest goals, they had a goal that was something, it stated something like this. We want to achieve, I think it was, I don't know, something like $1 billion by 2010, back then. $1 billion in revenue, I can't remember, revenues or something, by 2010. $1 billion by 2010. And everybody said, boy, that's a stretch goal. That's terrific. That's wonderful. However, as we then started meeting with John and his top team, we said, you know, the guy in the mailroom, does he care about $10 billion by 2010? All he's doing is making some CEO and senior level people rich, mm-hmm. you know, able to buy a home in Naples and buy a yacht. I mean, so what 2010, I mean, $1 billion by 2010 means nothing. It's a stretch, but it's certainly not an Everest goal. Does not have a profound purpose, the best I can imagine. So they decided to change instead. The goal was, I think it was, maybe it was a million people. I think it may have been 10 million people are going to have secure retirement by 2010. They just changed it slightly. The explanation was your grandmother is going to be secure. She is not going to have to worry by 2010 if she invests in Prudential. We will guarantee 10 million people having secure retirement by 2010. And all of a sudden, the guy in the mailroom says, man, I care about that.
Right.
I want my family, I want my children, I want my grandchildren, I want my grandmother to feel absolutely secure. You don't have to worry if we're in charge of your finances.
They made it and human.
That's exactly. It changes it from a stretch goal, which is often the case in organizations, to something meaningful, which is much more typical of what I'm referring to as an Everest goal. It matters a lot. I'm willing to sacrifice almost everything to get there. And most people who climb Everest, by the way, say, I put my life on the line in order to get this goal. And that's essentially what we want to do. We don't want to kill people off, but we want to say this matters a lot.
It matters, and you take it step by step, up the mountain, and you go up the mountain,
exactly.
And you stop someplace, and you take a rest, and you reassess. But what I love about that is instead of making it purely financial drivers, they're making it human drivers mm-hmm. that overflow out of the organization and into the community. And
right.
I think that's the people within the organization can get it to relate to somebody they may know outside of their organization. So now they have motivation to make it happen.
Yeah, and it moves from just achievement to that contribution.
Right.
And the best part of that is that it actually will pay off on the financial side. I mean, Prudential Retirement ended up growing 20% a year in an industry that grows 3-4% a year. I mean, they had times five,
wow.
For heaven's sake. I mean, it was a dramatic story of real improvement. Now, due to the senior team, John Kim and his group, I mean, they were spectacular because they lived this. I mean, they woke up every morning trying to figure out one more way to implement positive practices. It was great.
I want you to. We're going to go to break again. We're speaking with Professor Kim Cameron. He is the founder of a discipline called Positive Organizational Scholarship, and he's written tons of material and books about positive leadership. When we come back from break, Professor Kim, I want to talk to you. I want you to talk to our audience. There's a lot of professional people in Greenwich, how they can start to implement this into either the businesses they work for or the businesses they run. So stick with us. Folks, come on back and listen to that. We'll be back in a second. Bring me down, your love is too high. Bring me down, can't none. Bring me down, I said. Bring me down, can't none. Bring me down, your love is too high. Bring me down, can't none. Hi, everybody, it's Noreen Ehrlich, and this is Defiant Hustle Radio. I'm here with my co-host, Kelly Trepanier.
Hello, everybody.
And we have on the line Professor Kim Cameron, and he's an expert in positive leadership as it relates to organizations and businesses and institutions. So, Professor Cameron, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for spending time with me.
We have about 9 more minutes, so I wanted to take you into a real-life situation. And we have a lot of people in Greenwich who are very successful, or they get on the train each day and they go into New York City and they work for organizations or running their own businesses. A lot of businesses right now are in flux and they either have to change with the times or they're going to have to either downsize or go out of business. So I wanted to get your advice. Let's say there's a business here in Greenwich and it's been in business for a long time, but now it's sort of losing ground. What kind of changes could that business start to make today to shift their ability to achieve success again?
Well, gee, there's lots of answers to that question, and there's a lot of very smart people who are listening to this broadcast who have lots more experience than I do. I mean, one of the things that's sort of a truism is if you can't do it, you teach it. Well, I teach it. See, there's a bunch of people who can't do it. But there is some really interesting findings that have emerged. And some of it has to do with positive leadership and some not. And I'm sort of tempted to dive into some things that don't have to do with positive leadership. But let me stay with positive leadership per se, because that's one of the keys that we've discovered matters a lot, differentiates winners from losers and those who tend to succeed more than the norm. One of the keys that we've discovered, and it's not rocket science and it's not surprising, is that the leader matters. So depending on who you read, which study you read, between 20% and 30% of the outcome of the variance in the outcome of an organization's performance is due to the leader. Now, strategy matters, culture matters, incentive systems matter, culture matters. But if all of those are in place and you got a jerk for a leader, it's probably not going to work. So the leader is by no means the only important factor. It's just that it is the single most important factor, empirically speaking,
definitely,
in accounting performance. So the question then is, okay, well, what kind of leader would be particularly effective in helping organizations flourish? One attribute of leaders that's a crucial one, it's an important one, but it's only one, has to do with something called positive energy, being a positive energizer. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, for example, we've done research where let me describe in the following way. If you think about drawing a picture of an organization, the normal way is an organization chart, boxes and arrows. An alternative to that is drawing a network map. So you know what a network map is, and it's in the back of an airline magazine. So some cities at the hub, some cities are at the hub, some on the periphery, and you connect them with airline routes. You can do that in organizations, except people, rather than cities, become the nodes. And the question is, well, how do you connect people? Well, the most common way is information flows. Who gives information to whom? Who gets information from whom? And the research is very clear. If you're at the hub or center of an information network, you have an advantage. That is, your performance will be higher than norm, as will the unit you manage, which makes sense. All the information flows through you. You can decide what to share and so on. You have an advantage. You're going to do better. An alternative to information is influence networks. So who influences whom, who is influenced by whom? And again, no surprise, if you're at the hub or center of an influence network, your performance is higher than the norm, as is the unit you manage. And again, no surprise. Now, I don't know for sure what the percent is, but I'll bet it's 90% of the leadership literature equates influence and leadership. If you're influential, that means you're a leader. And that's okay with me, but there is an alternative. And we do research on this. It has to do with positive energy. Who energizes whom? Who is energized by whom? Now, what does that mean? So when I interact with Noreen, what happens to my energy? Is she uplifting, elevating, life-giving? Or is she exhausting, depleting, just sucks the life right out of me? In which case, she's a de-energizer. And I can get an energy network. I won't talk about the methodology of that, but I can get an energy network in any organization or any small group. And I've done that with lots and lots of organizations. Anyway, here's what's interesting about the research, and there's lots more to say about this, but your position in the energy network is four times more important in predicting performance than your position in the influence network or the information network. That is, energy trumps information and influence by a factor of four. Now, what's interesting about that is we're constantly managing information. Did you come to the meeting? Did you get the memo? Do you understand the goals? We're constantly managing influence. I mean, here's the target, here's the goals, here's the incentive system, get the results. The question is, does anybody ever manage energy? Does anybody ever get recognized or rewarded or hired or promoted for being a positive energizer? Because it trumps what we normally manage by a factor of four. Now, one more thing about that. There are lots of kinds of energy. One's called physical energy, which when I use it, it diminishes. If I run a marathon, I can't do it again. Mm-hmm. Another kind of energy is emotional energy. Again, I go to a ball game or get in an argument or something. I got to have recovery time. Mental energy is the same. That's why we have breaks. That's why we have semester breaks and so on. The fourth kind of energy is called relational energy. It's the kind of relationship. It's kind of energy that goes between two people. So when I interact with Noreen, it's not physical energy. It has to do with relational energy. That's what we do research on. And that, in fact, is the thing that trumps these other factors, the extent to which I'm uplifted, elevated, the extent to which Noreen gives me life.
It's now, rejuvenating.
Well, and Kim, exactly. As we're coming down to the last 2 minutes of our show,
yes.
What I kind of took away from that as well is that if I had the unfortunate fact of having a leader that wasn't inspired and was kind of negative and maybe was running the company into the ground, that I could still find a saving grace in that if I can increase my positivity and that relational energy, that maybe I could actually begin to influence and direct it in a way that was more positive and led towards better outcomes.
Exactly. Positive energizers, I mean, another one of the important findings is If Kelly is a positive energizer and I can just get around her, my performance goes up. That is, positive energizers affect the performance of other people around them. And the highest performing organizations have three times more positive energizers. That is, it's not inherent attractiveness or personality. It's a set of behaviors anybody can learn. So having Kelly be around me, helping me also learn how to be a positive energizer, affects the performance of organizations. Now, there's a lot more to say about that, but we're also out of time.
We have a minute, so I'm thinking, as you're speaking about it, I'm actually thinking about athletic organizations where a good coach, and this happens to work because I do business coaching and executive coaching, but where a good coach comes in with a new energy and can help you establish new goals. But when you're doing athletic coaching, you have to get people to believe in an end game and a goal and know their role in that organization. And that lifts the team up to cooperate and coordinate together towards an end result.
Precisely.
And you've got 45 seconds, or you've got about 30 seconds to comment on.
I would just want to make sure that we get to just thank you, Professor Kim Cameron from University of Michigan State.
Oh, delightful. I'm delighted. By the way, there's a book called Astro Ball. It was written right after the Houston Astros won the World Series. And one of the interesting stories is they drafted a guy to be, he was over the hill, past his prime. They needed him for the clubhouse. They needed him for the locker room because he changed the whole tone, the energy of the organization. They said, we think we can attribute 9 wins to simply having a positive energizer in the clubhouse. That's a World Series championship.
No doubt. No doubt. We all know those people, and we have to be going out of our way to find those people and try and catch ourselves when we start to lose our inspiration and make a commitment to ourselves and to our organizations and to our family and community
to stay positive. For joining Define Hustle
Thank
Radio.
Thank you very much, Professor Kim Cameron from the University of Michigan. Thank you.